Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 14th. Hawaii has set some ambitious green energy goals for itself, but how does phasing out renewable energy credits help with that? Why some advocates are angling for a special session. A state-of-the-art ship made waves a century ago. We learn how a historian is tapping into the state archives to trace the historic voyage. Spirituality and virtual reality collide on a church wall in Makiki, how one muralist is pushing the boundaries of his craft. And we wander into the culinary world, all about ulu. We hanaho a conversation about a book on the history of breadfruit. It's just been nominated for a James Beard Media Award. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The legislative session ended last week, but already there are calls for a special session. The issue that is of concern has to do with phasing out tax credits for renewable energy. Here with the story is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes, so how does this move jive with the state's ambitious green goals?
Yeah, so the state is looking to decarbonize its energy system by 2045. And where we've made the most progress is in solar, specifically rooftop solar. That's the largest source, one source of renewable energy on the grid on most islands. And one of the things that has supported rooftop solar, commercial scale solar, residential solar, is the state's renewable energy tax credit. But this year, lawmakers were looking for ways to cut government spending due to shortfalls in federal funding and also to preserve significant tax cuts that were enacted in 2024. And they have decided to eliminate some tax credits, including the renewable energy tax credit. The state typically spends about $100 million a year on that credit. But under Senate Bill 3125, which passed on Friday, they're going to completely eliminate that credit in 2031. And then starting in 2027, they're going to cap the amount of funding that the state is putting towards that. So they're only going to spend $40 million a year on that credit, less than half of what we've seen of expenditures in the past. And the way that that bill was written, that's going to apply to solar projects that were applying for the credit this year. So all of a sudden, projects that were counting on having that credit as part of their financing might not get the same amount of incentive that they were anticipating. And Rocky Mold is the head of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association, and he told me that this move could jeopardize projects that are already underway.
I went out and I polled HSEA members, and you know, we're looking at among a relatively limited sample size of our largest commercial and industrial users, we're looking at $460 million of investment just this year that are at risk of not moving forward because they can't count on the credit. They don't know what the credit would be, or being repriced at a much higher cost of capital for the project owners, which would then again be, you know, put the project at risk because all of the economics of the deal are subject to a new set of assumptions, a new higher cost point.
And so what does the solar industry want the lawmakers to do during a special session?
They have a lot of concerns about the language that's in this bill, but the thing that they want lawmakers to address as soon as possible is to set safe harbor provisions to ensure that projects that have already started this year are planned for 2026 aren't subject to these tax credits so that those projects can go underway as they were expecting.
And so why not just get the governor to do a line veto?
That's a great question. So that is a possibility. This bill has been passed by lawmakers but has not been signed in to law by Governor Josh Green yet. And he is a proponent of solar, specifically rooftop solar. So last year he passed an executive order calling for 50,000 new rooftop solar systems by 2030. He sees it as important to achieving our state energy goals. And he actually vetoed a measure that was passed last session that would have sunset the residential energy tax credit along with other tax credits. And he was citing their economic importance at that time. But he's in a trickier position this year because the changes to the renewable energy tax credit are part of a much larger bill that preserves historic income tax credits for many Hawaii households. So he cannot really veto one without vetoing the other. And he's supportive of those tax credits. He actually praised the work that lawmakers did on the bill overall on Hawaii News Now just on Tuesday. And I emailed the governor's office to ask if he would be supportive of a special session or if he was considering vetoing this bill. And he didn't respond directly to either question, but he said, but the office said the governor remains committed to Hawaii's clean energy transition and lowering the energy costs for local families. So we don't have an indication of his next move at this time.
And so how likely is it that lawmakers would consider a special session?
Yes, I've been emailing lawmakers trying to figure that out. A special legislative session can be called either by the governor or by a two-thirds vote of the chambers that are seeking to reconvene. And it's really hard to say if there's appetite for that right now. I haven't heard back from, for instance, the House Speaker or the Senate President or the chairs of the respective finance committees. State Representative Nicole Lowen is definitely interested. She shares many of the industry's concerns about the bill, and she thinks that it could have economy-wide impacts. And she's also really concerned about families that have already installed solar this year and were counting on getting a certain amount back from the tax credit in order to pay it off. And with the new language in place, it's suddenly unclear what they might get. And Lowen, like many solar providers, is also looking closely at an upcoming deadline for commercial solar, right? So this disruption comes on the heels of huge changes in federal support for solar. Last summer, Congress voted to roll back many federal incentives for renewable projects. And in order for commercial projects to lock in remaining federal tax credits, they need to break ground on new projects by July, this July. So the concern is that if commercial projects have to refinance because of this bill, they might not meet that deadline. So Lowen says that time is of the essence in terms of if lawmakers are going to reconvene in a special session.
The challenge there is that the timelines are so tight for the deadlines these projects have to meet that without at least some messaging to that effect, I don't know, you know, if we'll be able to act in time. So that's my concern, because it really is urgent that we do something as soon as possible.
So it's really a 1-2 punch. The federal and the state just, got the solar industry in the gut.
Yeah, it is kind of this existential moment for the solar industry. Between federal tax credits that used to be in place and the state incentives that were in place, I was talking to solar providers who say, you know, that used to cover half of a project, and that could suddenly all be taken away. So the federal government has already eliminated its incentive for rooftop solar, and we've covered that. I know you, Catherine, and I have talked about that on the show. There was a huge ramp up in demand for solar projects leading up to the start of 2026, but now there's been this huge cliff. Business has just fallen off for many companies, especially those who focus on residential solar. I've been hearing from companies who say they are doing a fraction of the residential installations that they usually do. And I've heard from businesses that they've had to lay people off. So these state changes could come amid what is already a huge period of disruption. One of the people that I talked to is a solar provider, Josh Mason of Blue Sky Energy. He works on Hawaii Island. And he actually had a really nuanced take on the state tax credits. And he said, they're not perfect. There's definitely room to restructure those to better support residents and local businesses, as well as help the efforts to achieve our state goals. But he says these specific changes right now will do more harm than good for the industry and for the customers.
The industry has had many setbacks over the last 20 years, 15 years, right? So they're not unaccustomed to managing those types of setbacks and changes. But right now, they're going through a very difficult transition as it is. And to add this to it could literally cripple it in a way to where you're affecting the outcomes long-term for the industry.
Yeah, a tough spot to be in. So we'll just have to see what lawmakers decide to do if they have that appetite for the special session.
Yeah, and from many that I've heard in the industry, they're sympathetic to the income tax cuts. They would much prefer that lawmakers address the language that's in the bill in a special session and leave those alone. But if they don't get that, they are going to be advocating that the governor veto the bill.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read the story online at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Saturday night on The Real Deal.
I can't help you.
We'll celebrate the birthday of one of the most creative jazz singers of all time, Betty Carter. Join me, Seth Marco, Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1 as we celebrate Betty Carter.
Support for HPR comes from Small Business Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, partnering with HMAA to provide health insurance for businesses across multiple industries. Learn more at smallbizhawaii.com.
A historic voyage carrying six scientists from the Bishop Museum set sail more than 100 years ago. It was an ambitious voyage from San Francisco to Tahiti. Called the Kaimiloa, the ship was the very first to send a clear radio signal across an ocean and one of the first hybrid ships that used sails and a diesel engine. This voyage has long fascinated historian Cesar Becerra as a bridge between two eras. We first spoke with him in 2024 about the Kaimiloa project, what is to be a three-volume book about that voyage. Becerra works as a historian aboard a cruise ship. He was actually docked in Hilo when he reconnected with the conversation's Maddie Bender. Becerra has traveled to Fiji, Samoa, New Zealand, and Australia, tracking the route of the historic voyage. He's now perusing through files in the Hawaii State Archives to learn more about one leg of the journey.
Just remind our listeners where you are on this journey yourself, right? Because this was planned to be three volumes, if I remember correctly. You finished the second one first in time for the centennial of this voyage.
That's right.
Give us the synopsis.
One of the reasons I did the second volume first, it was the centennial of the first voyage, but Kellum's life is fascinating. The gentleman who, you know, tricked out this wonderful Luzon, the original four-masted sailor, into this luxury yacht, along with Miss Kellum, who's a Carnegie niece. But the early days of his life and the preparation of that ship to the point where it could take this far-off journey after 20 years of being a lowly kind of a four-masted schooner. Now, it's going to take a while to kind of follow the progression. Then also the third book, it's a long story of what happens. But I end the first book dramatically one day before they actually get off the ship at Papeete in Tahiti, because the very next day, on the first of the year, literally Kellum fires the six scientists or kicks them off the boat. That's pretty dramatic. And soon thereafter, buys 3,000 acres of land in Morea. And you don't buy 3,000 acres anywhere in the world. That's a bold move. So a lot is happening, and there's going to be a lot of work to kind of decipher exactly what happened. However, with that said, one of the eyewitnesses of the moment that Kellum kind of parts ways with the scientists is Kenneth Emery, who's, you know, a titan in the world of Polynesian expertise. You know, he becomes like the ethnologist. He's, you know, young and 24 at the time, but later on he's our eyewitness, not only of talking as being the go-between with the scientists and Kellum, because Kellum has a distrust
and anybody that doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, and doesn't curse, and the head scientist, Dr. Ball, doesn't do any of those three. And then the other thing, he's also witness to the deal that Kellum makes with the Chinese banker to buy the land from a German outfit in Morea. So all that stuff's going to take a long time to really parse. And not only that, the rest of his life. So I don't see the first book coming out for another 3 years and the last book or another six. But we're learning more and more, definitely.
Yeah, and as part of that work, you shared that you've been in touch with state and university archives here in Hawaii. I imagine it has something to do with the fact that the six scientists you mentioned were from the Bishop Museum. Talk a little bit about what you've been uncovering there.
Absolutely. In fact, 9 years after the voyage, those scientists under Kenneth Emery would write a report, or the report, about their journey. And so, you know, in terms of the linear moment, nothing surfaces about the full understanding of that trip until about 9 years later. One of the reasons that is that Mr. Kellum, even though he parts ways with the scientists, or chases with the scientists for a whole host of reasons. Number one, it's unveiled that at first it was just going to be one scientist, then two, then somewhere along the line, someone says, pretty please with sugar on top, can you take four more? That's a lot of people taking up a lot of real estate. We still don't know the final, you know, who said what, who invited who on board. But we do know they part ways in Tahiti. But Kellum writes a rather large check that keeps two of the scientists going for another 2 or 3 years, purchasing or leasing another boat to go off and do. So he doesn't necessarily completely blow them off, but he actually funds another voyage. But still, those details are still incoming. And sometimes it takes a long time to suss out what exactly happened. But another thing that we've learned, kind of a mystery, was why they were in New Zealand for so long. And it was while I was in New Zealand doing research on a particular kind of a newspapers.com that we take for granted finding information today, is another set of archives online that led me to all these host of articles. And it turns out that on the second voyage, the Kaimaloa hit a rock. I don't know where, but it gets sent to Sydney for repairs. And the Kellums go to New Zealand to kind of wait out the fixing of the boat, the patch-up, so to speak. And they spend quite a long time, several months in Taupo, Lake Taupo in New Zealand. They also get involved with fishing tournaments, etc. So we're learning all sorts of things. And then they go off to Fiji and Samoa. So I went to Fiji, I went to Samoa doing research, and we're finding little by little what's happening at those places. So all in all, it's just a slow process, but we're on the case.
And I imagine it's a combination of interviews on site, historical documents, and photos. What sources are you looking to right now?
Well, I was very blessed with not only communication with Stacy Nipo of the State Archives, but she's been digging a little for me on Alan T. Bottomley, because the Kellums, when they came to Hawaii, Dubai, in the Kahala era, the old Bottomley place. Now, Bottomley is an interesting fellow. I haven't gotten to the bottom of everything, but he's a titan in his field in terms of owning land and owning businesses that inevitably sell land, you know, in big ways to the U.S. government for military purposes, etc. But we still don't have a photo of the old Bottomley place. I suspect that will change, but Stacy has found an address you know, nearby one of the caretakers. So we're kind of honing in on who Bottomley was and what was the house that Kellum lived in, and what triggered him to leave that comfort and go off into the sea for several years. We also learned that initially through some articles that Kellum had an idea to go actually sail the world for many, many, many years. That changes, though. He only really lasts 2 years out at sea and two different trips. So the trajectory of what Kellum is up to. We also learned that on his way out from Hawaii in 1924, he bumps into this very interesting French priest named Father Rogier, and he wants to buy Christmas Island. And the whole change of trajectory of the trip goes from Samoa over to Tahiti because Mr. Rogier, a priest who may not be a priest, he's got an interesting lady friend, may not be a priest at all, he says the paperwork's in Tahiti. So he hitches a ride, changing the entire journey of the trip. The scientists aren't very happy. They've been preparing to go to Samoa. So there's a little bit of a drama that we're like finding out that was happening on the ship itself. So Still a lot of work to be done, but it's a pleasure. I'm learning every day. One of the things that's fascinating is that Mr. Kenneth Emery gave an extensive audio cassette interview in the 70s with an author named Bob Noss, who wrote about Emery's life and his entire arc of life. And that's important because, you know, even though the interviews about the Kaimaloa take up a good bit of space in terms of the written paraphrased notes, so Bob paraphrased, there still are cassettes that are there. Unfortunately, they are, you know, they're cassette tapes and they're a bit fragile. So we're hopefully looking into a possibility where maybe one day we can raise some funds to digitize those, because that would give us a real impression of what exactly the fuller picture of what Kenneth Emery was telling us. He was on the voyage. He was privy to things that other people, scientists particularly, weren't, because he was the go-between between Kellum. He's even years later in the 1950s, he's an actual witness and told the son, Rotui, that the deal to get those 3,000 acres in Tahiti happened in an interesting way. In his telling of the story, or eyewitness, he invited this Chinese banker on board the ship who did not want to sell him the land, the 3,000 acres that the German outfit. And what he did, he says, come on over, let's have lunch. Just settle down, we'll talk about it. And as they're having lunch, Maddie, the boat, the ship, the Kaimaloa is kind of drifting away from the dock. And the banker is like, wait, what's going on? Oh, don't worry, we're just going to take a little spin around the bay. Of course, an hour later, they're really far out. He goes, look, let's just go to New Zealand. I'll have you back in a month or two. Of course, you know, Kellum is raising the heat on this deal, and he did, in the end, break down and sell him the property. Now, this is, again, from Kenneth Emery to Rotui, you know, one of the sons of Junior. So, you know, now, whether or not this happened this way, but it is on the audio cassette. It's been transcribed as such in a paraphrasing way, but not verbatim. So I'd love to one day listen to those.
I can see why you're drawn to this sort of history. But let me ask you, I mean, what about this voyage has captured your attention and your research for years now?
I think, Maddie, that's a good question. It's the end of one age on the one part of innocence on basis of the natives that they're meeting. Let's face it, this ship is so technologically advanced. Even the mere fact of making magical ice cubes out of nothing in terms of their view, you know, the next time they see this, it's old hat. The next time they see a ship that has motorized approach of raising the sails, it's old hat. So it's kind of like the end of that era. And it's probably the last great expedition of its kind to, you know, to put not just six scientists, but to massively build a lab that has the ability not only to take photos, but develop them and moving images to develop them and show them the next day. All these firsts lead me to believe this is the kind of the middle zone between what we think we take for granted. Expedition ship has all these technological advances. But before this, they didn't. Before this, you know, scientists were relegated to a naval cutter, maybe a closet or something. They'd have to wait to get back and study all their notes or develop their film. So the Kaimaloa is kind of like in that midway point between the old days and the new days.
The old days and the new days. That was historian Cesar Becerra talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links on our website later today where you can find out more about the Kaimaloa project.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
Live from the Atherton presents Next Wave Jazz at Hawaii Public Radio. Join us as we celebrate Hawaii's rising artists featuring the Lucas Utley Ensemble on May 23rd and the Christina Socor Trio on May 30th. This event is primarily standing room with limited seating available. Get your tickets now at hawaiipublicradio.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Electric, helping residents and businesses be prepared and informed in emergency situations with the Emergency Preparedness Handbook. Download at hawaiianelectric.com/prepare.
You know, if you happened to drive by Punahou School last week, you may have seen a man wearing virtual reality goggles and spray painting the wall of a church. That was Todd Estrella Johnson. He mixed virtual reality with spirituality in a 12 by 25 foot mural on the side of the Lutheran Church of Honolulu. It's a part of the Estrella Foundation's Mele Murals project, where Keiki can get involved in the painting process and also learn more about our native plants and Hawaiian culture. Johnson spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about how this mural came to be.
They just called us and said, hey, we'd like you to come in and talk to us about doing a mural. And they really liked our process because we heavily emphasize a spiritual component to it. So we teach them to meditate. And in the meditation, we believe that we're under the heavens to receive inspiration and we're on the land to take care of it. Kind of got to know your role, right? Stay in your lane. And in that way, by meditating, they'll clear their mind and see what ideas can flow to them, whether that's from a higher calling or the land or what have you. So that's how they came up with the ideas. I meditated with them and put the sketch together.
What brought you to that method?
I don't know what brought me there. Maybe that was going to be my direction in life. I feel like I've had, I don't know, other lifetimes leading me on that kind of a path. I think that now I'm at a point where I try to be a voice for the land and those that no longer have a voice. So kind of speaking for a spirit or whatever you want to call it. And it's been like powerful. I've had to learn to like move my ego aside and trust what comes. So in the creative process, there's a difference between me trying to force an idea into being versus sort of putting myself in the back and being like a passageway and letting the ideas flow through me. It feels different and comes out way cooler.
You know, maybe describe to me for people who haven't seen the mural, I guess, what did come out of that? What does that finished product kind of look like?
Well, to start, they said that they would like a connection to the place. They felt that people don't know that they're there, even though it's been forever. It's kind of like secretly nestled in between these big trees and a white building, so it kind of blends in. But in the meditation, you know, we asked the Aina what we should paint. And so we see what ideas come to them. For some, it's visual. Like for me, it's visual. I see pictures. But others are more aural and they might hear stuff or might feel sensations or emotions. And so we got to tune into what all of that is and figure it out. So the ideas that came out of it were about a spring that was on their front lawn before. This is in that Punahou, that ili, that area is called Punahou. And they said that a long time ago, the city came and filled it in. So there's a spring, and I think that it still feels alive under the ground there. So all of them got this spring in various incarnations. And then they also got a lot about the bird, Manuoku. A lot of people got rainbows. They got things like mountains. So what we ended up with was an image of like the clouds parting and like that kind of holy light coming through. A waterfall falling down through the clouds, like, you know, the gift of life coming to us. And then the trees that are parting are kukui trees. So you can see the leaves, and then it turns into the stars to represent kupuna. So it shows the birds as like, kind of like, you know, a dove, a symbol of peace, and then our connection to the past and the present and the future. And then there's a rainbow kind of dividing the mural, and you can see into it like the mountains of Manoa, Konahua Nui. Then in the foreground, there's the spring, and there's a bunch of ohia lehua around it, kind of like a lei, but representing what used to be on the mountain ridges of Manoa long ago. Like they would say it'd be like a carpet of ohi, of lehua blooming.
It must feel like almost a heavy responsibility, I guess, then to take a lot of these ideas and what people are imagining and then kind of incorporating it into one kind of cohesive piece. How do you go about that?
I sit with it. I'll meditate a little bit. I'll lay out all the sketches on the floor and see what are the common images that came up for people. And then I'll just try to be open. So it doesn't feel heavy. It feels light. It feels like full of light. And it's a huge honor for me to be able to paint for people like that.
And I think something that people saw, I definitely saw, was that you're doing it with these very funky looking goggles on.
Oh, so one of the young guys on my crew, his name's Graphbot, he taught me how to use this VR headset.
What is going on with that?
So it's so weird because when you look at me, you can't see my eyes because it's plastic. But then inside of it, I see the wall and everything around it. And there's a program to put your sketch in there and lock it onto the wall so that I can trace it. It ain't perfect. It kind of moves, or I haven't figured it out. I don't know. I'm the old guy that's behind on the technology. But it made outlining, it saved me hours.
Oh, really? It was that effective?
Yeah. And then if I wanted to make edits, I could do it on the sketch, put it in there, and just draw it on the wall without having to come at night with a projector and shooting it.
Moving on to your choice of medium, you use spray paint. You're a bit of a tagger.
Yeah, I come from style writing. I, you know, started by hopping the fence and painting the canal with my buddies back in the breaking days. And then I fell in love with it. I ended up going to San Francisco for art college. And before college even started, I was painting the project rooftops with some graffiti guys. And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to go into art. But now I use paintbrush and spray paint. So I find that the paintbrush allows all the people to participate. They can use the brushes because it's a longer learning curve for the spray can. And then I can come afterwards and put the spray paint details on top of it. So the colors last longer, it's dynamic, and it's inclusive.
I think that's something that's really cool so far about what you've told me about your workflow and your process is that it is inclusive, right? Like you rely on a lot of feedback and a lot of ideas from other people. And I think that's something that's so interesting where I think a lot of artists maybe can feel like it's my vision.
I think the ideas that come to me that way are way cooler than what I come up with. it's powerful. I think it's one thing to have a gift and it's another to share it or to use it in the service of others. Some would say that every creature in the universe was designed for giving, right? The tree gives you air or fruit and other things like that, right? Everything has something. So what is our role to give? Are we just taking or consuming, or are we producing and sharing? And I think with a skill or a talent, first you learn and then you earn. And now I'm in that phase where I can return.
And you are returning in a lot of ways. I know the Estria Foundation is more than just this mural. And it's more than murals itself. It's about art education and art advocacy, especially with our Keiki. Could you tell me a little bit more about what you do at the Estria Foundation?
We do Mele murals, which this is one of those. And that's a big part. I think teaching people to turn off their brain and open their na'au and receive the inspiration is huge. I mean, you're sort of doing the work of a higher being. And then we have an intercession program where we offer programming during the week, like spring, fall, summer, when school's out. And it's based off of Mele murals, but we have so much more, a lot of Hawaiian activities and learning.
And well, I guess what brought you to making a foundation like this?
Oh, my buddy was one of the Twitter founders, and he was like,
what?
Dude, I got to give this money and they're going to build bombs to, you know, with taxes, or we can start the projects we always talked about. I was like, all right, let's just do it. He's like, spend it. I'll give you more. All right. So stupid me, I spent it and he gave me more.
No, I've never really heard a lot of people say my buddy was a Twitter founder.
Yeah. So what a blessing. You know, we're still the best of friends. And then from there, it enabled us the opportunity to go and become legit and chase grants and make a go of it.
And what does Estria mean, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, man, when I was a kid, I made that up for a graffiti name because all the graffiti writers were taking words, right? Dare, risk, dream. But you knew that in another city was going to be somebody with that name and you're going to have to battle for that name. And as a naive kid, I thought, oh, artists have exotic names like Leonardo, Michelangelo. Yeah, I never thought that our names were exotic. So I made something up. And then it kind of stuck. I built a reputation with it. Then years later, a man told me, oh, in Portugal, estria means like to stretch. So the Latin is stria, striate, to expand. So everything in your life, you're always trying to expand. I was like, oh my God, that's totally me. And then as I came back to Hawaii and got spiritual mentors, two Hawaiian ladies, they told me, oh, your name comes from esoterica. Like, what? So you're telling me like no one's going to understand what I'm painting? No, no, no. You're taking what few know and you're making it more commonly known. Like, oh, that's really cool. Okay.
It's kind of the power, I feel like, sometimes of murals is that, as you said, it gives a voice to the land, to the place. A lot of times what I'll see with muralists is that they'll be working on a piece in a very public space. And a lot of people just stop and ask them, well, what are you doing? How do you approach those situations, I guess? Is it a good time to just explain what's going on when people are asking you, hey, what are you doing?
I think it depends how close to the deadline you are. So if you have time, yeah, share, right? And if it's getting close, just say thank you. But I try to tell them how we're changing the space. And the kids that participate, most of our participants are students. They see a wall go from nothing that they've ignored every day of their school year to suddenly something empowering, and the color changes the space, and people are complimenting them or having some connection with the space. Like, in changing that space, you've changed them. We also sometimes have to clear the space spiritually, so I'll call in people to help with that. The land holds memory of things that happened before, so certain places always feel like, ooh, I shouldn't be there, I gotta get out. It's like, it's gotta get cleared and healed. The land needs healing. And once they clear it and do that, then it's like an empty umeke, like you can fill it with light. So the kids come in with creativity and laughter and new ideas, and that becomes the energy that the land holds. So then going forward, what happens in that space is going to be connected with that kind of a vibration.
I think, as you touched on, cleansing the space and the way that a mural can really change a space, it's so true. I see murals every day. I see the one with Chris Amor and Dukan Omoku on what was just a building, and now it's a beautiful piece of art. It's just a visual reprieve from city life, and it adds so much character to the place that we live. I guess, why do you think murals are so important, not only as a form of art, but as a service to the community?
Well, some people's role are the warriors or the farmers, the fishermen, right? Legislators, the konohiki, to take care of the resources. And I think we creators, our role is the storytellers, whether it's song making or dance, whatever the format. It's to tell the stories, to connect us and keep us connected to our places. Our Hawaiian language connects us to our ancestors, right? The names of the mountain ridges, the winds, so that we don't forget who we are, what family we're a part of, where we came from. And I think that's a big part of our role. I also find that through the meditation, we learn, like we have these stories that may have been written by some white guy with a lot of spare time in the 50s, right? Pele, Hiiaka, Kamapua'a. But what we don't know is what has happened in that story afterwards. So we might hear of strife, of fighting or disagreement. And through the meditation, we discover that those people have made peace. They work together to take care of this place. And we wouldn't know that if we didn't try to connect to it. You know, the land has a voice. It just doesn't speak in words. It doesn't have a mouth. And in order for us to take care of it, we're going to have to quiet all of this stuff and hear it.
Hear it. That was muralist Todd Estrella Johnson and HBR's Kevin Allen. You can find out more about the Estrella Foundation and its Mele Mural program by heading to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, here on The Conversation, we've been bringing you voices around the Ulu movement that has been building over the last four decades or so. And the latest bright spot is that a book about breadfruit has been nominated for a James Beard Foundation Media Award. Russell Fielding is the author of the book Breadfruit, Three Global Journeys of a Bountiful Tree. It traces the history of Ulu as it spread across the globe, and it charts a journey through evolution and colonialism. Fielding is an associate professor at Coastal Carolina University. We're rebroadcasting a conversation that he had with HPR's Maddie Bender last fall.
For many years, I've been working, doing research in several islands in the Southern Caribbean, most especially Barbados and St. Vincent. And I was not studying breadfruit. It wasn't my research subject, but I was eating it all the time. And I was resting in the shade of the trees. And I was watching other people harvest it and prepare it. And I got interested to learn more about this tree that didn't look like any other trees in the area, and the fruit that certainly didn't look like any other fruits in the region. So I started researching breadfruit as just kind of a side project for a while, but it grew and grew. And I went looking for a book about breadfruit. I wanted to check out a book from the library or buy one. And I found that none existed. There were books that mentioned breadfruit and books from a very long time ago that maybe served to guide people who wanted to grow breadfruit. And they came with a lot of technical horticultural advice, but I couldn't find a book that told the story of breadfruit. And I remembered back to a piece of advice that Toni Morrison gave, and it was in an interview that was conducted with her, that if you go looking for a book and can't find it, that means that you need to be the one to write that book. So I decided to embark upon a book project, and breadfruit or ulu would be the subject.
And in many ways, your research took you on the same journey that the crop did. So talk a little bit about the places you visited and the ways that you immerse yourself into this global story.
That's true. That's a good observation. I took the same journey, or one of the same journeys, as breadfruit, but I did it in reverse. So I started in the Caribbean and learned about ulu's Pacific origins, and traveled back to the Pacific to seek out some of its more distant history. And also, because it doesn't only live in the past, to seek out evidence of it in contemporary Pacific societies. So I traveled to the Pacific after having already begun the breadfruit research in the Caribbean. And going there, I knew that Hawaii would be an obvious place to spend a lot of time. And I'm sure cumulatively, I did spend more time in Hawaii than any other group of Pacific Islands, but I didn't restrict myself to working in Hawaii. I visited Micronesia and the Marianas and Guam and Samoa, and also American Samoa, and several islands through French Polynesia, including Tahiti and Moorea, little island of Mopiti, and one of my favorite, the Marquesas. So this research project really took me all across the territory that ulu or breadfruit had visited and settled long before I came on the scene. And so in visiting these different places, I was able both to get a sense for the history and the journeys that this tree would have taken in the past, but also learn from the people who are using it today. In every one of those islands, breadfruit's being cultivated and consumed and appreciated by people today. And I was very fortunate to get to learn from a lot of those people.
Here in Hawaii, we know of ulu as this canoe crop, right, brought here by the Polynesian voyagers. But it's so interesting to me to think of how the practice of growing and cultivating and cooking and even just mythologizing might have changed between these different islands. So if you could just briefly compare, contrast, what are some of the interesting ways that ulu and the production of it grew for the thousands of years that it was spread across Polynesia?
So it changed a lot. And the reason for the change, or for most of the changes, comes down to the way that it's cultivated. Ulu is almost never planted by seed. Most of the varieties that grow now, except in the Western Pacific, don't even produce seeds regularly. Most listeners will know that ulu growing in Hawaii very rarely, if ever, produces seeds. And when you cultivate it, you take a cutting. And so what you're doing is creating a clone. So you're cloning a tree that has the features and the characteristics that you want to copy. And that clone, or that cutting, can be planted in the same field as the tree from which it was taken, or it can be wrapped carefully and put onto a canoe and sailed all the way across the Pacific Ocean. That's how ulu was dispersed all those thousands of years ago by the original Pacific voyagers. So we can think of a map of the Pacific Ocean spreading from west to east, which is the direction that, by and large, it was settled. And we can see that as a timeline of ulu development, where the traits that were desirable would arise and be carried further east. So what you get as you go further and further east across the Pacific is a refinement of what people want ulu to be. So the large fruits, the tasty fruits, the seasonality, the seedlessness, These are all characteristics that people would have selected for as they were planting the crop on different islands proceeding further and further eastward.
Wow. So it's a scientific story, too, of artificial selection. Is there any way that that influences the types of contemporary ulu preparation across the Pacific? Like, if you have a smaller fruit, are you more likely to prepare it a distinct way?
Yes, different varieties have different recipes that they're better suited for. And even fruits from the same tree, when picked at different times in their process of becoming ripe, will be used in different ways. One of my favorite stories of the ways that different varieties of ulu are used differently comes from that little island in western French Polynesia, Mopiti. Mopiti is a tiny island. I think its ring road that encircles the island is only about 8 kilometers long. But it has such an incredible density of ulu varieties. Dozens of varieties grow on Mopiti. And they have a tradition there where each variety of ulu is paired with a different species of fish. So when a certain variety of ulu is in season, you're fishing for that species of fish because you're going to eat them together as the same meal. And the byproduct of this is that when that variety of ulu goes out of season, you stop fishing for that fish, which ends up being a form of conservation, even though no one really considers it that way.
That is so cool. But this combination of history and contemporary practice that you looked into is only really a third of the book that you wrote. There is also this whole other history in the Caribbean that I am not sure listeners will be as familiar with. So just briefly, how did ulu shape everything, but shape history, even as it spread beyond the Pacific?
So the story of ulu reaching the Caribbean starts off in kind of a dark period. When European countries had set up colonies throughout the Caribbean, mostly to produce sugar, but a few other cash crops as well. And of course, these plantations were served by slave labor. The British and the French and some of the other countries, or some of the other people who were managing these plantations, knew that the less they had to spend on maintaining their enslaved workforce, the more profit they could make. So they went looking for food crops that would basically grow themselves without a lot of human intervention. If a tree can produce food, and if that food had been compared to bread, and no human effort is needed, or very little human effort is needed to grow that food, then that's an economic win for the plantation. So the British dispatched a ship called the Bounty to travel to Tahiti to take cuttings of ulu from Tahiti and to bring them to the Caribbean for planting. And with the mention of the ship's name, most listeners are going to know what happened. This is the ship that had the infamous mutiny. The captain was disposed, sent off on a lifeboat, miraculously made it back to England, but the crew took control of the Bounty, returned to Tahiti to pick up the women that they had met while they were there harvesting ulu, and sailed off to settle Pitcairn Island, where their descendants still live today. The captain made it back to England, was exonerated for losing the ship, was given another ship and a second chance, and sent back to Tahiti to finish the job. And this time he was successful. Breadfruit was introduced in the Caribbean, first the island of St. Vincent, and then Jamaica in 1793. And it was spread throughout the region after that as a cheap or even free food for enslaved laborers. And so you might imagine that the people who were intended to be fed by this food started off with a pretty poor image of it. Breadfruit was not popular at all. It wasn't even considered fit for human consumption in the Caribbean for the entire time that slavery persisted. But after emancipation, the Caribbean people who were now free started to reconsider breadfruit. And today in the Caribbean, there's still some suspicion, there's still some stigma of slavery in some places and among some people. But by and large, it's been redeemed. And it's a beloved part of the food landscape in most Caribbean islands, to the level that many people don't consider it to be an imported food at all. They think of it as a native food that they've always had. I compare the degree to which breadfruit is loved in places like Barbados and St. Vincent and Jamaica with the degree to which ulu is loved and has been loved in Hawaii and Tahiti.
What's one preparation that's typical in the Caribbean?
My favorite way of preparing breadfruit comes from Barbados, and it's to take an entire breadfruit, don't peel the skin off, just take it as it is, wash it, and place it on an open fire, and turn it from time to time so that it gets cooked evenly. You want the skin to turn nice and black, and then the breadfruit is cut in half, and the core is scraped out, and some of the fruit's flesh is scraped out as well, and diced and sauteed with whatever ingredients you want to add to it. I usually like mine with some peppers and onions, some black beans are a nice addition. Douse the whole thing in garlic butter and then place it back into the scraped out breadfruit, almost like a bread bowl that you have with soup sometimes. And then with a spoon, you eat the filling. And if that's not enough, you scrape whatever remaining fruit is there until you get to the black outside. And by then, you're usually going to be fully satisfied.
Is there anything else that you want to add or anything that you think listeners here in Hawaii should know about your book?
For me, this whole adventure of following breadfruit around the world for several years has been such a learning experience. I've learned about botany and horticulture, which are not fields that I studied previously. I'm trained as a geographer. I've learned about history in new ways and in new areas that I had not gotten into before. I think, though, that the most important lessons I've learned are neither culinary, botanary, nor even historical or even really academic. I learned lessons from breadfruit that I've tried hard to apply to my own life. In Hawaii, for example, listening to the stories of breadfruit's origin, of Ku, the god who descended into the ground during a time of famine and came back as the first ulu tree that anyone had ever seen, that teaches me the lesson of self-sacrifice. It teaches me the lesson of giving abundantly. And as the recipients of that tree showed, it teaches the lesson of gratitude, of being grateful for the gifts that we're given. In the Caribbean, where breadfruit was rejected for so long, and even while it was rejected, it continued to produce food. I've learned the lessons of redemption, of making up for past wrongs. I mean, breadfruit was considered to be a co-conspirator with the enslavers. You know, it was an accessory to the crime of slavery. And yet, it redeemed itself, and the Caribbean people mostly, by and large, have forgiven it. And so I learned lessons there about making up for past wrongs and forgiving those who have legitimately come to one of us with a request for forgiveness and with a true apology. I see breadfruit as exemplifying some of the best aspects that humans aspire to have. And I think that if we all spent more time paying attention to elements of the natural environment that we don't normally think of as having human qualities, that there's a lot that we could all learn from what we see in nature.
That was author Russell Fielding with HPR's Maddie Bender. Fielding's book, Breadfruit, Three Global Journeys of a Bountiful Tree, is one of three nominees in the Reference, History, and Scholarship category for the 2026 James Beard Foundation Book Awards. This interview originally aired in October of last year. Well, that does it for this Thursday. Up tomorrow, we check in with a lei shop owner in Makawao, how she supports local growers during her busiest season. Give us some feedback, call our talkback line or email us, or reach out on social media. Want to listen back to something you heard on the show? Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.